This is a News Laundry podcast, and you're listening to Reporters Without Orders.
Order, order. Hello and welcome to Reporters Without Orders, a podcast where we talk about what made news, what didn't, and some things that absolutely shouldn't have. I'm your host, Snigdha, and joining me today over Ringer are Ayush, Basant, and Ayan. Hello, guys.
Hello.
Hello.
Hi.
How are you coping with the quarantine?
Bura hal hai.
Sabka bura hal hai.
Trying to learn how to live like this.
Yeah, we might have to in the future.
Ayush ko intellectual baat karni zaruri hoti hai har jagah pe. Jo man mein hai wo bolo na.
अरे सच में कोशिश कर रहा हूँ ऐसे जीने में, मतलब इसमें इंटेलेक्चुअल क्या है.
बसंत आपको तो ऑफिस जाने
को बहुत चाह रहा हूँ, कम से कम एक सप्ताह में एक बार तो मिलना चाहिए हम लोगों को. और आज तो अच्छा दिन भी, आपका जन्मदिन भी है
यार, मत याद दिलाइए. इट्स अ वेरी इट्स अ हॉरिबल डे
लिसनर्स, इट्स स्निग्धास बर्थडे.
आई वाज टेलिंग थैंक यू. So, listeners, in case you're wondering why all of us are sounding so weird, it's because all of us are working from home and also recording this podcast from home. And before we begin, I want to tell all the new listeners about News Laundry. We are 100% ad-free news platform, and we need your support to stay afloat. So please subscribe to us and pay to keep news free.
And listeners, if you're listening to this podcast on any other platform like Spotify, Stitcher, remember, we have a website, newslaundry.com, where you can head over to and find lots of other cool stuff that we do, like reports, podcasts, interviews. You should check them out.
All right. So let's begin with some bizarre news, although nothing seems bizarre anymore, isn't it? Who wants to go first?
I'll go first. So I saw pictures on social media that after the Prime Minister last evening made a request and, you know, announced that there'll be a lockdown, people obviously they rushed outside and they poured out the streets even today morning. So outside some of the shops in these places, to maintain social distancing, they've marked these circles at every few meters, and it felt like we were in kindergarten, you know, or you were doing the one of those stage performances where they would put a tape marker and that's where you stood and that's where you spoke, you know, you were Macbeth and all that. So I thought if so many of us are actually, you know, just grown-up children, and the state actually has become a teacher, and that's what it feels like.
That's so true.
You know,
this
reminds me of a similar scene from Kerala. Okay, Kerala, like in many other things, loves to be ahead of the rest. So a few days back, I saw a video on Facebook. So usme kya hua tha? The scene is from outside a liquor shop. So all the people.
Oh yes! Oh my god! That is brilliant.
So yeah, they were also like standing in circles, okay, and maintaining at least 3-4 feet from each other. So obedient, so disciplined, they're patiently waiting to get their bottle. It's funny,
yeah, that was really funny, actually. Very inspiring also. Anyway, Basant, aap bataiye.
Aksar koi ghatna hoti hai to ek dar rehta hai ki koi apne bacche ka naam us par na rakh le. तो इस बार डर था ऑलरेडी कि कोई अपने बच्चे का नाम कोरोना ना रख ले, लेकिन ऐसा हुआ है, वो भी उत्तर प्रदेश में. एनडीटीवी की रिपोर्ट है कि एक परिजन ने अपने बच्चे का नाम कोरोना रख लिया. यूपी में हुआ. तो ये है.
What a time to have children.
It's a great break from Rahul and Atul and Alok and, you know, all the usual names in our society.
So Ayush and Ayan and Basant.
Basant is a very nice name.
Yeah, I like
Basant. Yeah.
But I like Pajjar Kumar better.
Isliye apne maa-baap ko thank you.
Pajjar Kumar.
Ayan, what about you?
Okay, so my bizarre news is from the United States. I saw this video on Twitter where a Republican, you know, Lieutenant Governor from Texas, Dan Patrick, was talking to Tucker Carlson of Fox News, okay? And Dan Patrick basically said, he suggested that, you know, grandparents in the U.S., you know, should be willing to die in order to save the economy for their grandchildren. this is obviously in the context of the coronavirus. So he suggested that if he had to make the sacrifice personally for his grandchildren, then he was like ready for it. And he suggested that to his countrymen as well. So Tucker Carlson was also kind of, you know, dumbfounded, and he kept staring without any expression.
You know, Trump also came out and said this yesterday, that he said that the lockdown might end very soon because the cure cannot be a bigger problem than the problem itself. And that is, it's like a lobby is starting to form in the US where conservative economists, Republican politicians, where they're saying that the economics is so, it has taken such a hit, the economy, that the lockdown might have to actually be shortened, or you know, it has to be relieved.
Oh wow, sounds scary, man. While the economy is certainly slumping, gun sales in Colorado have doubled, according to Colorado Bureau of Investigation. So there's this company called DCF Guns in Castle Rock, and they basically started delivering firearms and ammo to their customers. So,
okay, but what,
so yeah,
what
that is my bizarre news of the week. I wonder.
Yeah, hope they don't end up killing, you know, people from Southeast Asia.
Yeah, hopefully not, man. I don't know, people. But I think it's because people are panicking so much. Yeah. Also because of lack of information or whatever, they don't know, that nobody knows when it's going to end, how it's going to end. So Americans, they only feel safe when they have guns on them.
Yeah, exactly. It's more of a psychological thing, I guess. Yeah.
Yeah, true. Kill the virus with a gun.
Boom, boom, हमारे यहाँ वाले तो गोमूत्र से ही मार दे रहे हैं. अभी एक वीडियो देख रहा था फेसबुक पे, एक मौलाना साहब थे, एक महिला सामने बैठी हुई थी, और वो बच्चों वाला बंदूक होता है ना, जो प्लास्टिक वाला, उससे कोरोना मार रहे थे.
Oh my god. Well, yeah, nothing, that's what, as I said earlier, nothing is bizarre anymore. Moving on to the reports that you guys have done this week, last week. Shall we begin with Ayush and Basant's story, the report that you guys did on Delhi carnage?
Yeah, sure, why not?
Yeah, so listeners, those of you who've not read this story, you must. I mean, you cannot miss this. It's a great investigative piece. And while most of us actually forgot what happened in Delhi before the pandemic hit, Ayush and Basant, they didn't stop, and they kept going to Northeast Delhi over I think an entire week, right? You guys kept visiting Delhi. And
more than that. I think more than a week and 10 days.
Right. So the story is titled Delhi Carnage, the story of one mob, two drains and five murders. So tell me, Ayush, can you please introduce our listeners to what the story is about?
Okay. So when I was doing my story on the Ankit Sharma murder, I thought, okay, this is one murder which everyone seems to be talking about, but there have been 12 other bodies that are being found across Northeast Delhi, and there were 11 other men besides him, which did not find the same sort of attention in the mainstream media. In fact, just the day after Ankit Sharma's body was found, four bodies were taken out of the drains. So we just pursued this simple idea, and it took us a little time to go to the police and get the details of these 11 other bodies which were taken out of the drains. That took us alone 4 days because the police was very uncooperative. But once we finally got the details, all we had to do was to go and meet these families. So as part of this, we've met four other families, and in one family there were two people, so five murders. And that was a simple idea, and that's what we've covered. Not just these families, actually, but people who saw these bodies go by in the drains, a man who took out one of the bodies. So we've also spoken to these people, and that's how the story has come out.
Yeah, so I mean, the beginning, the first paragraph of your report is very, moving in a sad way. Ayush describes how this woman who was standing on her terrace, she saw a body appear in the drain that is just below her house, right?
Yeah.
So, guys, unfortunately, Basant cannot join the call because network issues. Everybody is working from home, so I think internet is slowed down. Ayush, can you tell us more about the dead bodies that were found? Who were they? About the identity of these people who were found in the drain?
Yeah, there were two common links to all of them. First, of course, they were all Muslim. And second was that they were all came from working class backgrounds. So one of them did odd jobs in the Northeast Delhi area as a laborer. One of them drove a rickshaw. Right. And, there was another one who actually sometimes what is known as Beldari in North India, you know, that carrying things from one place to the other. He was a Beldar. All these daily wage jobs. Mm. So these were the things that, were the common threads.
Right.
But one more interesting thing was that they were also all murdered by the same mob. I mean, most likely murdered by the same mob, but four of the five bodies that we looked into were found in the same spot.
I see.
Same part of the drain. Yeah. And just near where they were found is an intersection over the drain, which is called a pulia.
Yeah.
Where on the night of the 25th, I had gone to that pulia and there was a mob standing there. So I know there was a mob there. And the next thing we know is that the bodies are found beside this pulia. Mm. So we can put two and two together. Right. But the fifth guy, he was found in front of the Gokulpuri metro station.
Yeah.
His body had flown on the 1st of March because on the 29th, there had been a huge, there had been rainfall across the city. So the drains had swelled. Mm.
This is Aas Muhammad.
This is Aas Muhammad, yes. So his body had been found, unlike others, near the metro station. But then that drain is downstream from the pulia, meaning that it came down from that space. So we know that it could have come from that pulia itself. And because his home is also around and he would travel from one place to the other, you can take a good guess that he was taking that route, as a lot of others were. So these are the three things actually that were common to all of them. They were Muslim, they were working class, and they were most likely murdered by the same mob.
I think you came across this mob during the violence, right? When you were reporting. It was the same mob?
Yes.
So what?
Yes.
So what was going on when you saw them? Yes. What, like, describe your encounter?
Well, I had come across the mob because they had set some slum dwellings on fire where Muslims, used to live. Even though the Muslims had fled the day before, they still set the houses on fire. And we were interviewing people, other slum residents. And I was talking to the police and the mob stood at the bridge on the Nala. And I remember the police was there, the UP police was there that night, 25th of February. And we told them that, you know, there's a mob there. They just set things on fire. And they said, you know, that is Delhi. That area which was 50 meters away is Delhi. This is UP. We can't do anything. And since I was with four reporters, two of us went to near this mob. I thought, I mean, I feel so scared of the idea that they did that now, because now I know they murdered five people. But there was Raghu Karnad and there was Nikhil Karyappa, and they went and they went near the mob and they met two policemen which were from Delhi police, and they told the policemen told them that he should leave. This is not a safe time to be here.
These policemen were standing with the mob.
Yeah, they were standing
and
just
these were
beside
Delhi policemen.
The mob. Yeah, they were Delhi police, and we've made this point in our report that when the police investigations are on, most of these two policemen can easily identify a good number of people who were part of the mob. And a lot of people also told us that these people who made the mob came from local colonies. And of course, you know, that's how the dynamic is. The local police always knows
exactly
who in the area is the troublesome kind, who will do what.
Right.
who has done what. The police always knows these things. So they can easily be arrested and they can be prosecuted. But I think only four people have been... in the eight murders, only four murders have there been arrests and four people have been arrested, which is way less than, you know, if you look at Ankit Sharma's murder, where five people have been arrested and they're taking CCTV footage, they're talking to eyewitnesses. So,
yeah, way more proactive.
Yeah, I'm worried it might not be covered that way.
In Ankit Sharma's case. Ayush, can you tell our listeners a little bit about Aas Muhammad, how old he was, where he worked?
Right. So, it's a very strange, coincidence, and it's very morbid that Aas Muhammad, he was 25, sorry, Aas Muhammad was 30 years old. And the night where when he was murdered, I had encountered the same mob that killed him. But not only that, on the 1st of March, when I was coming out of the metro station, his body had just floated by and it had been taken out. We met his family, and his family told us that they live in the Shakti Vihar area of Mustafabad. And they said that they'd been in that area, no violence had happened. And the community elders had come out. The Hindu men had told, you know, their own young that don't do anything. The Muslims had done the same. So there was peace in that part, in that quarter. So I think what his brother said was that because there was peace in Shakti Vihar, Aas Muhammad probably thought that outside, you know, the world is also as peaceful as it was there. So he stepped out sometime in the morning of 25th. And on the 25th of February, the violence, the communal violence begins in the afternoon. Around 1 or 2. So he left in the morning and he never came back, of course. And his family, you know, they were actually so scared, and there was a lot of rumors going on. So they were told that if you go to the police station, there are mobs on the way, you'll get killed. Probably not rumors, because that's what happened to one of them. But they didn't go to the police for a long time, and they finally found the body on the 9th of March. So he's murdered on 25th. His body is recovered on the 1st, and the family meets them on 9th, which is 2 weeks goes by.
His body was in the drain for about 4 to 5 days.
4 to 5 days, yes. And I've seen pictures of his body, and I mean, it's a very horrid sight to see, you know, a murdered man in the drain, and that too, the way the bloated body, and it was ugly.
Yeah. So you saw many pictures like this of the other people who died as well, right?
Yes.
So, these bodies had a lot of injury marks, right? In spite of the bloating and the, you could still see the injuries. Is that correct?
Yes. I mean, it was the death was calculated to be as painful. And, you know, you look at the injuries and you could imagine how it all happened. So, for example, we've met a family in which two brothers were murdered called Amir and Hashim. So, look at the pictures of their dead bodies. And, you know, one of the younger brother, he was slit right from his chin down to his torso, you know, near his navel. There's a huge gash. Almost a meter long. And when we went to near the bridge one day, sometime in early March, you know, where the mob had collected, and we talked to some kids because we thought we should talk to these children, because the children, you know, they wouldn't have filters. They will tell us the truth. Unlike the rest of the people who were just saying nothing happened here, even though obviously that was a lie. So we talked to these children. Couple of children actually told us that they had seen these brothers getting murdered, and I think one of them had been picked off directly from the bike, and the other one who was driving the bike was so scared that he had jumped directly into the drain with the bike. And then they came and then they killed him. And when his body was found the next day, I talked to another eyewitness who told me that his body was still stuck to the bike. You know, it was almost as if he was in that same position. So it was, the murder was very gruesome, it was very brutal, and it was, I think they just smashed them with whatever they could find, rods and swords and knives, God knows what.
I have a question to Ayush.
Yeah.
Yeah, so now obviously everything regarding the riots has taken a back seat, but since you and Basant followed the aftermath of the riots, you know, longer than some of us because of this story, so... could you update us with, you know, the status of the investigation into these murders? I mean, of course, you have mentioned that some arrests have been made, but what kind of evidence is being examined by the police, or, I mean, anything, any other important detail that, you know, we should know regarding the investigation?
So the problem, the very first problem here is that the police is being very, you know, opaque about the whole investigation. And there are three different teams working in this set of murders. So there is the crime branch, there is the SIT, and then there's the local Thana. So you talk to some investigative officers at a police station, they'll tell you that the investigation is going on at crime branch. They don't know anything. You meet the second guy, he'll give you all the details. So it's always very, it's very confusing. And it's, I think, kind of, because we went to the DCP office, we went to the SHO, we tried to talk to him. It took us 4 days to meet him. And when we met him, he just simply denied everything. You know, he just said he won't give us the information.
He said
the SHO practically knows everything. He can give you anything.
Yeah, he said, you know, he was on holiday, right?
This is the SHO from Gopalpuri.
Yes, Pramod Joshi. The police is being very... Yeah, he said he was on a holiday when the whole riot was happening. And the information gathering itself has become so difficult that I can't give you the status of the investigation. For example, the four murders that I have mentioned came from a Times of India copy where I read about this. But when we asked IOs and SHOs, they just did not give us any information.
Yeah, so it looks like that, I mean, most likely nothing will happen. I mean, no one will be booked because of these murders.
Yeah, it's I think the investigation will be similar to all other investigations in the riots of 2002 or 84. It took decades, you know, for the people who were guilty to get to be punished. And I think this one is going the same way.
Right. I mean, the fact that Aas Muhammad's family waited for days to approach the police says a lot about, you know, the trustworthiness that the public has on police.
Yeah, true.
Ayush, can you tell me a little bit about the other victims that you profiled?
There was one other man called Bhure Ali, and there was another young boy, 25-year-old, called Hamza. And both of them, again, Hamza, in fact, had come to Delhi last year, you know, late last year from Meerut. Yeah. In Meerut, he used to run a computer shop. He used to work at a computer shop.
Yeah.
And when he came to Delhi, we saw pictures of it. And he seemed like a young man who enjoyed, you know, wearing nice clothes. Even the, sorry to sound dark, but even the dead body photos that we saw, he was wearing, you know, a nice brand, a nice sweatshirt of a nice brand. The same thing in his pictures. And so much so that even though he worked in a shop that sold, you know, high-end merchandise. In fact, the night he was murdered, he had gone to check up on his shop. He had gone there to see if everything was all right, if it had been looted or not. And he never came back, like all of them. So he came for a better life. He died. The second guy, Bhure Ali, his story was also a tragedy because his wife had been murdered a few years before in Northeast Delhi. And you know, now he had passed away. He again, daily wage worker. He had told all his family not to go out that day. But I don't know what happened to him. He himself went out. That's what his family told us. But after telling everyone not to step out, he stepped. And he was also 30 years old. He has two children. And I mean, both of them are orphans. And they've been taken care by the grandfather, by the grandmother.
Yeah.
So in any case, these are very poor people, very poor background. They, you know, the father of this of Bhure Ali, he runs a chai shop in Loni, which is the UP Delhi border. So very tragic stories.
Yeah, very tragic.
Ayush, tell me a bit about more about the FIRs in these cases. You mentioned it in your story that a lot of details were missing, right?
Yeah. I mean,
like about the violence of the attack.
Exactly. The FIRs only say that, you know, the bodies were thrown into the drain to destroy evidence of murder. And they said the people who were responsible, they said unknown rioters. And then even in terms of building a timeline or, you know, putting out any good information. It's if you read FIRs in India, they're so verbose, you know. this person, the son of this, uh-huh. and the resident of this place, and this and that, and though it's difficult to read, and the Hindi is very jarring. And when you read like 2 pages of all that, you realize at the end of it there's no important information. So in all these murders, you wouldn't find mention of who the people who killed them were unknown rioters, but where did they come from? Did the police talk to anyone? Who informed the police that there was a body? Who took out the body? Is the police looking for bodies?
Right.
And that's one thing, very particular, we noticed this. That most of these bodies were taken out after the locals alarmed the police that they were there, which means that the police itself is not looking for these bodies. Okay, understandable, because it's a riot, you have to do a lot of things. But since March 2nd, when the last body was found, reported to be found, no other body has come out. So either there is no other body or that the police is not looking for it. And we asked the police, are you looking for the bodies? And they said, MCD is looking for the bodies. So you go ask them. It's a typical way of obfuscating the whole question. So that is noteworthy.
Yeah. It's strange because the fact that, policemen, whether UP police or Delhi police, they were present when this mob was around. And even if they were not a part of it, I mean, I'm sure they would have had an idea that people were getting thrown into the drain. Right? Yeah, so the fact that they don't want to look is very suspicious. It's like, I don't know. It's very strange.
Yes, yeah.
So Ayush, last question about this report, what was the whole I know it's a very bad question, sad question to ask, but what was it like looking at all those dead bodies, rotting, those pictures, talking to the family members as a reporter?
The stench of the, because we were, the drain was central to the story, and wherever we were near a drain. So I've come to associate that stench of the drain with, almost like the stench of death.
Yeah.
And we were even getting a little bit paranoid because we were walking by the drains, Basant and I, and sometimes we would see, these dogs trying to, tear apart something. And then we thought, oh my God, is that a body? Or is what is that? And it would turn out to be an animal, or it would turn out to be a stack of, some garbage. So and people also in the area actually do that. You stand by and they'll look into the drains. Yeah. And looking at these bodies, meeting these families and hearing these stories, it was just, it hurts your spirit, in some sort of a way. And the only way for these for even these families to find closure and to heal is that the police does the investigation. So I really hope that happens, because the way these people have been murdered, it's not easy to forget that how the extent of the brutality. But the law enforcement authorities can make a lot of difference by just looking and finding and arresting and prosecuting people who caused this kind of violence.
But seems very unlikely. I mean, considering the role of the police, how they were during the during these incidents, it seems very unlikely, right?
Yeah.
And now there's a lockdown, so I don't know how much of the evidence will just perish, and what the investigation will go towards.
Yeah, exactly. The more time that passes, the more is lost, right? When it comes to these investigations.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, the narrative has also changed. The news, the discourse has also changed now. So attention is going to be less on the riots. So,
I mean, it does make sense in a way, because obviously, you can't ignore something like a pandemic.
No, obviously,
It's completely taken over the news cycle and all that. But there's one more question I have. It's the guy who fished out the dead body. Arun, his name was, right? Can you tell me a little more about him?
Yeah, he was just like the policeman. We went to his house for the fourth time, and then we could find him. He was apparently not too happy with the media attention, and he was even paranoid that, talking to the media might get him into trouble for some reason. So he was scared that all the media attention might get him into trouble. So he wasn't staying home, is what he told us. But we finally met him. Mm. And you know, he's a young man. And he told me that he jumped into the drain to recover the bodies because he was around. He knew how to swim. And the police, you know, also pushing him to, you know, beta kuja, kuja to kuja. And then he jumped and he took Aas Muhammad's body out. And he didn't know that person's name or his identity till I met him and I told him.
Oh.
And when I was talking to him and he said, he told me that he actually felt doing it because the fact that he could take out the bodies and that they would reach the families and there would be the ritual burial. Yeah. It would give the family some sort of closure. So that's what he told me. Yeah. But
he's an official diver of the police?
No. He was just someone who lives nearby and was standing by the road.
Yeah, exactly. So police didn't even have their people around and instead they asked this guy to do their job. Anyway, listeners, as I mentioned earlier, this story is a must read. And because of the extra amount of time and resources that Ayush and Basant had to spend on reporting it, we have put it behind the paywall because, as you know, when advertisers pay, advertisers are served. But when the public pays, the public is served. So to get good reportage, you need to pay for it. So please subscribe to News Laundry and do read this story. Now, Ayan, moving on to your report on the pandemic. So you've written two pieces, right? Let's begin with the one where you've talked about how Indian healthcare system is mostly unprepared to deal with COVID-19.
Yeah, exactly. So the first case of a coronavirus patient in India was reported in the month of January, okay? Towards the end of January and beginning of February. And it was reported from Kerala. So the indication was already there that the country needs to prepare itself, you know, adequately for in terms of the medical, the public health infrastructure.
Yeah.
But despite that sort of a signal, unfortunately, we did not make adequate arrangements. And now, from the beginning of March, when the virus has, you know, struck us all of a sudden, this underpreparedness has, you know, come out to the light, and now the consequences are being felt by the people, because as of Monday night, there are only 122 certified labs in the country to conduct the testing, you know, for suspect coronavirus patients. And out of those 122 labs, 116 are government labs, and the rest of the six are in the private sector. But even among the government labs, only 89 are functional as of now. So the rest of the 27 are still under, you know, the process of getting ready and functional. So it clearly shows that we are not prepared for a possible disaster. And disaster is going to strike us more.
Yeah, definitely. It's already struck.
If you look at it has already struck. I mean, now I think the number of confirmed cases stand at somewhere around 560. I mean, that's the last figure.
562,
But again, many experts are saying that, you know, in a country of India's proportion, you know, having 1.3 billion people, I think this number, 562, is very clearly underreported because because adequate testing has not happened in the country. So there can be so many cases which have not been confirmed by medical experts, but people are still roaming around, you know, carrying the virus in their bodies. So, and if you look at you know, the rate of spread over the last 2-3 days, it's actually spreading faster with each passing day. Newer regions have been reporting the virus, because I remember I think in Sunday and Monday the spike was 81 cases within 24 hours. The next day it was 101 within the same amount of time. So so now, I mean, of course, the government has still maintained that we are yet to enter the risky, you know, phase 3 of the coronavirus, that is community transmission. But I mean, people are of the opinion that we have actually entered, we have already entered the phase. And if that happens, so this amount of medical equipment and certified labs is not going to be enough, to say the least. And we are staring at a huge medical disaster in the coming days.
Even Prime Minister, in his address last evening, looked very grim. I mean, he looked very worried, and he himself mentioned that, you know, countries like Italy and US, they've got top class healthcare system, and even they are not being able to cope with it. So it is sort of an admission, right, that he knows, basically. He knows that we're not.
I mean, and I think, neither the Prime Minister nor any Chief Minister nor any top politician minister will admit in public that the situation is actually, you know, much grimmer than what people are seeing, because that will send a very, you know, panicky message across the country, and that we cannot afford at this time. But these people, the people involved in this entire process, they have actually sensed that the situation is far worse than what is being conveyed to the people. So that is why, you know, the kind of lockdown instructions and all the arrangements that we are seeing, that is why all these things are taking place. And what is more worrying for a country like us is the fact that, I mean, people... So, first of all, of course, people believe in lots of nonsense that, you know, peddle on social media platforms. And then yet millions of people are still taking this thing very lightly. You know, they haven't understood the seriousness of this thing, because as you have mentioned, I mean, you know, countries which are known for their, you know, good public health infrastructure, the countries in the West, they have faced such a hit because of this virus. If these countries can suffer, then the situation will be far worse in a country like us or in any other country in South Asia. So the people need to take it far more seriously and should, you know, obey the lockdown instructions as religiously as possible. If you looked at how people behaved last Sunday during the Janta curfew, it was ridiculous. I mean,
indeed, shameful.
Appropriate for that.
Yeah, shameful.
Shameful and criminal, I would say. Because they did exactly what they were asked not to do. They came out to the streets, burst firecrackers, played dholes and started dancing and singing and whatnot. So the entire appeal of the Prime Minister was, you know, turned into a tamasha. So that's really ridiculous.
Exactly. Yeah, I wanted to ask both of you, in fact, about, you know, it's a very thin line when it comes to reporting these issues, right? A lot of media houses, they want to focus, they just want to focus on positive stories, you know, to... I don't know, to make the public hopeful, or I don't know, avoid them from panicking or whatever. But do you think that's a good idea, not telling people the reality of the situation?
So my opinion is that, I mean, of course, these kinds of reports which actually bring out the truth, these reports obviously stand a chance of, alerting the people and sending a panic button among them. But at the same time, these are the reports which also pressurize the government to, you know, take up initiatives and be proactive in terms of dealing a crisis like this. So I think because of the second factor, reports, media has to play a very proactive role and has to keep nudging the government to, you know, adequate itself with better facilities, better infrastructure, and, you know, better policy decisions. Because if that doesn't happen, then the situation will, you know, simply just, you know, spiral out of our hands. So the media has to play that, you know, critical role, despite the risk of, you know, creating panic or whatever.
I mean, in a country like India, I mean, I think it's even more important for the media to be proactive, because, you know, so many things can go unreported, or... you know, especially when it comes to the government, which is, it's not like they're not doing anything. They are, I'm sure they're trying their best. But a lot of things they might miss, right? Because there's so much to pay attention to. So it's so important. What do you think, Ayush?
Yeah, I definitely agree that, you know, you have to sort of maintain alarm as a journalist, because trying to do positive stories is almost, you know, almost like standing at the cliff of a canyon and looking at a river raging into a bloody ravine and saying, oh, that's a nice fish. You know, that doesn't work. You're on the cliff. So, and
that's a nice,
I did a piece.
I did a piece
today in, you know, arguing that a century ago, when the Spanish flu had hit America, 675,000 Americans had died. That's, I mean, you know, that's 6 lakh people. And that's more combined than American casualties in First World War and Iraq and Afghanistan and, you know, even the Second World War.
Right.
So many people had died. 28% of America had been affected. And one of the a good historian who's written a book on the Spanish flu has argued that a lot of this blame for this goes to the media at the time, which because the war was on, in an effort to, you know, maintain the morale of the armed forces of the people
to be mobilized for the patriotic war.
Yes. Yeah. So just to say that everything is fine, you know, it completely missed out. It did not convey the fact how dangerous the whole the pandemic was in that time. And I've given an example of this one celebration rally in Philadelphia in September 1918, where doctors and public health officials told the district's public health chief that, you know, you have to call off the celebration, that this thing is contagious. And he did not do that, saying everything is fine. And within a week, I think 45,000 people were affected. And within 6 weeks, 12,000 died. So you have to be alarmed in the way you convey your information, because you don't know the positive here is what? I mean, a good, some things like a policeman who helped a patient get to the hospital. Yes, but would that patient survive in the hospital? Would that hospital have enough equipment?
Exactly.
That should be the story.
Exactly.
So I'm suspicious of this positive angle, but yes, I agree with Ayan that there should be a good amount of alarm.
Exactly.
And also to put it in a perspective, Snigdha, I mean, now that we have entered the crisis, people can see that, you know, professionals involved in public health services, doctors or other health workers, they have been constantly demanding for personal protective equipment, which includes...
in fact, so one of our listeners, who is a doctor, he wrote to us. He wrote to us recently, just yesterday, actually, talking about the lack of masks and other gowns and other stuff that they need at the hospitals.
Yes, so public health professionals from all over the country, they have been clamoring for these things over the last few days. Because there is, you know, a starking shortage of these personal protective equipment. And without these healthcare professionals, they are actually, you know, setting into a trap, because while treating, they simply might contract the virus and end up dying. And that's what exactly happened in Pakistan.
And that has happened. Yeah,
that's what I'm saying.
Yeah.
So if these shortages, if these kinds of things are not brought out by the media, then the government will not come under any kind of pressure to tackle the issue. So, for example, over the last few days, there have been such reports in, you know, in the media. So, a Scroll did a good investigation. Then Indian Express also pulled out some nice statistics, which actually talked about, you know, the alarming figure of our hospital beds and the availability of doctors in the country. So, these things have to be extracted and put in the public domain so that the government is pressurized to act and act sooner than later.
Right. Ayan, you also did a piece on the lockdown and the migrant workers all over the country, in fact, not just in Delhi, who are, you know, struggling to go home. Can you tell us a little bit more about that? And also, can you start with the attack on journalists during the lockdown?
Yes. Though the Prime Minister declared the countrywide lockdown last night, but most states had already entered into a lockdown a day or two earlier. So, on Monday, what happened was that there were at least 3-4 incidents in my knowledge where journalists were attacked or you know, stopped by the police while they were commuting between workplace and home. Now, the lockdown instructions exempt people involved in essential services. And by essential services, they mean doctors and other
media,
public health professionals, the police, the fire safety people, and also the media, because the media is very vital in a crisis like this. So, but despite that specific exemption, journalists were stopped, heckled, and beaten up on Monday. And I can tell you about incidents from Delhi and Hyderabad. So in one incident in Delhi, what happened was that a journalist from the Aaj Tak news channel by the name of Praveen Kumar, he was stopped near the AIIMS Trauma Center in Delhi. This happened at around 1:30 p.m. on Monday. And he was actually going from Vasant Kunj to his office in the Noida Film City. So he was stopped by the police. And then he was asked to show his press card, his identity card, because the police did not know that he was a pressman. So he showed his identity card and he identified himself as a journalist going to work. But despite that, the policeman on duty, he just took his I card, then pulled out his car key and just moved ahead. And then this guy went after the policeman, requested for his belongings. But then the policeman, you know, started abusing him with filthy language. And then the policeman was joined by some of his colleagues as well. So they then later took him inside the police van. And then during the course of the argument, they just, you know, ended up beating him up. And one of the policemen on duty, he actually said that, yaar, ye to aise nahi manega, isko thoda maar ke dikhao, maro harami ko. This is the language the policeman used. So this guy was beaten up. And then he could escape the spot only because several cars had already lined up in the area and they could, you know, have been possible witnesses to the violence. So the policeman just let him go. And Naveen, of course, that same evening, he put out a detailed statement on Twitter where he described whatever happened to him. So this is one incident from Delhi. On the same day, there were two incidents from Hyderabad. So on Monday night, the bureau chief of the Hindu newspaper in Hyderabad by the name of Ravi Reddy. So Ravi Reddy was he was returning from work. He was going home and he was also stopped by policemen. Around 2 dozen policemen near the Begumpet flyover in Hyderabad. Now that is a very busy passage in the city. And this guy was stopped and he was also asked by the police to just, you know, go back. He was not being allowed to go forward because he was going to his house in Secunderabad, but the police did not allow him to go. Then he again went out, talked to a senior policeman on duty and told him that he was a journalist. He was, you know, returning from work and by the government instructions only he was allowed to move around, even in terms of a curfew. But the policeman did not listen to him. And similarly, you know, what happened to Naveen, this guy was also abused in a very, very way. And then he was also, and then he some policemen just held him by the neck and threw him inside the car. So then was also obviously shocked. And then he called up one of his senior colleagues, who in turn informed the DGP of Telangana. And then only the situation came under control. And this so there was another incident in Hyderabad around the same time. So this Ravi Reddy only told me that some bureau chief of this popular Andhra Telugu newspaper called Andhra Jyoti. So that bureau chief of Andhra Jyoti, along with two reporters from the regional media, they were also, you know, stopped and attacked by the policemen. Because they were also trying to...
multiple cases of journalists being attacked while reporting during the lockdown, in spite of the Prime Minister himself mentioning the importance of media's role in such a scenario. Are you guys, my last question, are you guys concerned? Because you guys are, I'm sure you will be out to report...
See, I mean, in my article also, I made this point that in extraordinary situations like these, people who are empowered to enforce these lockdowns and curfews, they actually assume greater powers than in normal times. And that is why it's very risky. They can actually do anything they want, just in the name of, you know, ensuring law and order and government instructions. And there have been examples of police personnel, you know, fining thousands of people on the streets of Europe and, you know, getting into clashes with people. So these instances have actually come out in the last couple of weeks. Now, obviously, there is a lockdown. Everybody understands the significance of this lockdown. But people at times might have to step out for, you know, meeting their essential needs. And if journalists who are exempted by government orders only, if journalists could be attacked, or doctors could be attacked, and just imagine the situation for the common people. So it's really risky.
Yeah. Ayush? That way. Right. Ayush, do you have anything to add?
Yeah, I think the police I've had experiences with the UP police and the Delhi police. Both of them are highly unpleasant institutions. I mean, Salted Basant couldn't be here, yeah, but he would have told you how the Delhi police treated him.
Yes.
So
So
media is not treated well even in normal times. This is a time when everyone's panicking, and the way Ayan told the stories of these journalists who are assaulted, now I'm quite worried. But then this is also, again, your part of your profession, you know, just the way you have to negotiate with an angry mob or a, you know, angry subject. You have to talk to an angry policeman. So unless and until we are really assaulted, this is something that it's a good skill to pick up.
Right. All right, guys. So let's move to recommendations.
Okay, who will start?
Ayan, why don't you? Yes. You can recommend multiple things, because everybody is at home, all our listeners, everybody's looking for stuff to watch, to listen to read. So please go for it. Be generous.
So I'm recommending this piece by Yuval Noah Harari. Yuval Noah Harari, as you know, that is a very renowned historian from Israel. So Harari wrote this piece in the Financial Times. And it's titled as The World After Coronavirus. So in the article, he tries to make the argument that the world as we see now will completely change once this the pandemic is over. And many of the measures, many of the strategies being the governments across the world might just become, you know, normal, you know, might just become the norm of the day.
A permanent thing like surveillance. Yeah,
and that will eventually change our social, political, and cultural lives. So that is the larger argument of this piece. Now, of course, you will read it and try to understand it in a much better way. And also to inform you, generally Financial Times articles are behind the paywall, but many other publications, they have also lifted pieces related to the coronavirus, you know, lifted the paywall above for all the pieces related to the coronavirus pandemic. So you can just read it for
Right. And anything else that you want to suggest?
The report by Ayush and Basant, which is up on our website. So because that, I think that that's a very, very painstaking effort, but that was a very really nice report. So everybody should read it.
Yes. All right. Ayush?
Oh, yeah. I want to recommend this book called The Great Influenza, The Epic Story of the Deadliest Plague in History, which is on the Spanish flu during the First World War. And it's written by John M. Barry, and people can download an EPUB and a PDF on Library Genesis online. And it's a very good book, because only because it's comprehensive, but it gives you a scientific, medical, political angle to this one plague. And of course, also does justice to the fact that there was a war going on, and, you know, brings out that very well. It's a very rich book. And I mean, journalists any journalist who listens to this podcast might benefit from it, because then you understand, when you look back at how people today ask questions about, you know, a pandemic that was a century before, then it gives you a perspective how you can do the same in the present in your own way. So it's eye-opening in that way, and people should read that.
All right, so I have multiple recommendations. First is this Ayush's piece itself about the Spanish flu. It's titled Spanish Flu: How Information Policing and Nationalist Propaganda Worsened a Pandemic a Century Ago. And it's a must-read piece about how journalists now can learn from it. So that is one piece. And the second is a movie on Netflix. It's a Japanese film directed by Manbiki Kazoku. And if you liked Parasite, then you're going to love this movie. It's about this, it's a bunch of people who don't really have proper jobs. Somebody works in the laundromat, somebody, you know, two of them are just shoplifters, including a child, and they just pretend to be a family and how they get by. And it's brilliant. I mean, if Parasite was great, then this is, I don't know, another level. So you guys should watch it. And my second recommendation is Daily Dose, News Laundry's Daily News podcast. Since now, so guys, we've made Daily Dose much longer and more detailed. So the first half of the podcast is just about coronavirus. We are giving you updates from each state and all the information from India and from the world, apart from other news stories. So do tune in every day. And I think that's about it. You guys read and watch all of this, and then we'll come back to you next week with some more recommendations. And listeners, if you liked what you heard, please rate our podcast on iTunes or whatever platform you tuned into. We also do a bunch of other podcasts like Hafta and Awful and Awesome. Better the rating, more the reach, and that means more subscribers, and that in turn means better content.
And listeners, if you like this podcast, then please do spread the word. Tell your friends, family, make them listen to Reporters Without Orders from News Laundry. And please, yes, as Snigdha says, pay to keep news free, support independent media.
Yes. Also, listeners, we're planning to start a new podcast on coronavirus. And listeners, if any of you are interested in contributing to this podcast that we want to do on coronavirus, please write to me at snigdha@newslaundry.com. If you work in the field of microbiology or virology or communicable diseases, please pitch in. It'll be great. And also, please write to us at contact@newslaundry.com with Reporters Without Orders in the subject line. If you have any suggestions, any criticisms, you can also leave your comments on Twitter or Instagram or Facebook. And with that, this podcast is adjourned.
All the News Laundry podcasts are available on Stitcher, iTunes, and any other podcast platform.
Please subscribe to News Laundry. Help us keep news independent. Catch all our podcasts on news, pop culture, current affairs and sport. Visit newslaundry.com. Follow us on Facebook, Twitter and Instagram. And subscribe to our YouTube channel.